I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. I'm looking today at an excellent book I picked up a few years ago while reviewing Roots and Culture by Eddie Chambers, The Cultural Politics and the Makings of Black Britain. And it's a fascinating kind of meeting of modern history, modern British history, and cultural theory, and it sort of posits the question of, well, how do particular cultural formations happen? What sort of makes them? And obviously, it is historical and social experience, the experience of black people coming to Britain in the 1940s from the Caribbean. And particularly the generation that follows, their children and grandchildren, shaped by the experience of racism in Britain, the experience of inequality, and also the experience of developing new forms of community, new forms of identity, in order to counter that, to face it in a proactive way, and to create identity shaped around the idea of, I guess, resistance. So I'm looking at the second chapter today, and it begins to sort of go into, I beg your pardon, it's not the second, it's the first chapter, silly me. And it begins to go sort of into the kind of the background of this of migration to Britain, and the long historical view. Anyway, Eddie Chambers writes, "Black people have been present in Britain for many centuries, going back as far as Roman times. Whilst this presence has historically ebbed and flowed, it was not until the relatively recent period of the mid-20th century that Britain's black population swelled significantly and, within a period of little more than a decade, came to represent an intriguing and somewhat conspicuous new aspect of the British populace. Britain has always, of course, since the earliest times, been a destination, temporary or otherwise, of a long line of peoples. Among them are the Huguenots, Jews, Celts and Saxons. In more recent decades, we can also speak of Irish, Italians, Poles and others. The crucial difference between these groups and immigrants of African, Caribbean and Asian backgrounds is a pretty blunt one of skin colour. While white migrants within a generation or two have become assimilated and accepted as British, black immigrants and their offspring have inevitably maintained a particularly conspicuous presence that has contributed to them not readily being regarded as British in the same ways as their white compatriots. This systemic, perennial impulse to regard those with visibly darker skins as somehow embodying different traits and characteristics has meant that the gradual formation of a separate cultural identity for Black Britons was perhaps inevitable at every turn. Certain pathologies ensured a persistent othering of black people with cultural consequences that this book seeks to examine. And we'll look at further into this book over the coming weeks and months. The narratives that this book seeks to understand began in the years of Caribbean migration to Britain from the late 1940s through to the early 1960s. The Caribbean community in Britain, the Trinidadian-born journalist Claudia Jones noted, in fascinating detail, the demographics of the period of immigration. Immigration statistics, which were approximates from the Caribbean community in Britain. Immigration statistics, which were approximate estimates compiled by the one-time functional West Indian Federation Office, Migrant Services Division in Britain, placed the total number of West Indians entering the United Kingdom at 238,000 persons by the year 1961. Of these, 125,000 were men, 93,000 were women, 13,200 were children, and 6,300 were unclassified. A breakdown of the islands from which these people came showed that during the period of 1955 to 61, a total of 142,825 were from Jamaica, from Barbados, 5,036, from Trinidad and Tobago, 2,282, from British Guyana, 3,470, from the Leeward Islands, 3,524, from the Windward Islands, 8,202, and from all other territories, a sum total of 8,732. So the vast majority of people coming to Britain from the Caribbean were from Jamaica, the largest and most populous of the Caribbean islands. To understand the push-pull factors that contributed to Caribbean migration, we need to look at conditions that existed in Jamaica and to varying degrees the other Caribbean islands and countries in the years following the end of World War II. Those in English-speaking in the English-speaking Caribbean had, as was mentioned previously, been brought up under the British flag, so much so that many of the young men of the British Caribbean, like their white British counterparts, enlisted for duty in the war effort. In the words of Robert Winder, Britain, in the years following the war's end, though far off, was now an attainable destination for more than just the odd writer or cricketer. It was also, thanks to the Empire, much more familiar. The colonial administration had given West Indians a grounding in Queen and Country, in Shakespeare and Tennyson, in W.G. Grace, Kennedy's Latin Primer, and the Lord's Prayer. They'd grown up singing There'll Always Be an England and Land of Hope and Glory at Assembly. Many of the Christian names, Nelson, Milton, Winston, derived from British heroes. A reverence for Britain had been carefully planted. Now modern steamships brought the land within reach. Another commentator, Ernest Cashmore, alluded to the affinity with Britain with which those countries, such as Jamaica, had been inculcated. In his book, Rastaman, the Rastafarian Movement in England, he quoted a gentleman who recalled, "In Jamaica, children are taught all about Britain, its history, its heroes, etc. So coming over here, we knew what to expect, or at least we thought we did." Such sentiments are reflected in a feature on coloured immigration, in inverted commas, by the way, it's not a term we particularly like to use here, coloured immigration in an edition of the Picture Post magazine of 1949. Early in the piece, the writer, Robert Key, noted that it is important to remember that all colonial coloured people of whatever origin or class have been brought up to think of Britain with the greatest pride and affection as the mother country. West Indians, it says in brackets, even talk of Britain as home. While these sentiments allude to the pull factor, that is to say, which in part at least attracted would-be immigrants to Britain, there was also a concurrent push factor laid out by Winder in a similar cogent and lyrical terms. Writing specifically about the post-war conditions in Jamaica, Winder noted, The Jamaica they, the West Indian troops, returned to was still devastated after a tremendous hurricane of August 1944, the worst in 40 years. Ancient trees had been toppled, fruit groves trampled, the roofs had been whipped off like napkins. Even before the storm, the economy was in tatters. The price of sugar, by far the dominant export, had sunk to the point where the crop was hardly worth harvesting. Fields of cane ran wild and died, and there was no work for the men who once hacked sweetness from the hills. The Caribbean tourist boom was a long way off. The Western bourgeoisie couldn't yet run to swanky winter breaks on these palm-fringed beaches. Aside from a tiny trade in coffee and rum, there was little to do but subsist on fish from the ocean and whatever mangoes, bananas, maize or breadfruit poked through the rubble. So there are some really interesting insights there. And I think first, the kind of culture that had been developed through the process of kind of colonialism, the affinity that had been educated in colonial society in the West Indies, and to see kind of Britain as the mother country, Britain as a sort of like a cultural, almost spiritual home for all the peoples of the empire, which of course, as we know, when people from India and Pakistan and from the Caribbean came to Britain in the 40s, 50s and 60s, they were treated with anything between indifference to outright hostility. And the idea that this kind of mother country, this metropole, this centre of imperial civilization, was sort of somehow kind of the ultimate destination for the empire and its subjects, is thrown into kind of stark and really quite painful reality for the people that arrive in Britain. But also it's worth mentioning, and I think it gets under-mentioned, that there were kind of acute economic hardships in, as it's just mentioned, in places like Jamaica that had been devastated by a hurricane. And also post-partition India and Pakistan are riven by, obviously, kind of inter-ethnic communal violence, and the kind of the economic troubles that go with that, and the kind of the overall kind of aftermath of the Second World War in Asia, which had been an immensely kind of painful and a costly period of time. In 1949, writes Eddie Chambers, Robert Key described the economic challenges of life in Jamaica, faced by many in stark terms, referring in part to migrants such as those who had previously come to England on the Empire Windrush. Key stated, "They've come here partly because of the economic impoverishment of their own country. The unemployed figure for Kingston, Jamaica, alone is 70,000. This figure represented a significant proportion of the city's labour force in so many ways, beginning with the widespread implementation of the use of enslaved Africans in the latter half of the 17th century. Issues of labour and employment have always been vexatious in the Caribbean." This is Eddie Chambers writing. "Enslaved Africans have been brought into the region for no other reason than to work the plantations and the sugar mills, or otherwise attend to the serving master class, the plantocracy. The end of slavery in the early decades of the 19th century and the technological developments in manufacturing and harvesting processes meant that a massive proportion of the black populations of the Caribbean, black Caribbean countries effectively and rapidly found themselves either unemployed or pitiably underemployed. Upon the abolition of slavery, businesses that had relied on wageless labour to turn profits thereafter became, for some of their owners, liabilities rather than assets. As a consequence, labour and employment in the Caribbean became difficult and aggravating issues. Thus, the Caribbean has had long since been a region with a surfeit of labour, and consequently a region from which labour has to be has been exported. So it makes sense when you look at the long history of the Caribbean that this is a region where labour was stolen, where people were enslaved, where labour value was extracted for them from them forcibly, and obviously without compensation, without pay. And that's what makes the plantations not only viable but enormously lucrative. The moment that you are forced to employ free labour and wage labour, it becomes less so, and this spurs a process of mechanisation that, you know, capital doesn't want to abandon its profit margins if it can at all avoid that. And so mechanisation once again led to a surfeit of human beings. You know, there's a surplus of human beings there that you don't need, and the easiest way to deal with that is for those people to go somewhere else. And again, after the Second World War, the need for cheap labour in Britain, for the rebuilding of Britain, suddenly kind of is suddenly quite pronounced. And also the British economy has lost several hundred thousand workers to the war. These are significant numbers of people that would have returned to jobs in manufacturing or transportation or something else. So moving workers around and moving workers, sort of encouraging workers to come to places where they might be needed, was a kind of a long part of the kind of the labour history of I suppose of modern capitalism.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The only valuable export, wrote Key, was labour. Caribbean workers knew all about this. They had known little else. Even with their own islands, they often had to trudge for miles in search of piecework on the plantations. And for years they had been hopping over to Florida to pick fruit. In the first half of the century, up to 150,000 Jamaicans, a tenth of the population, went job-seeking in North and Central America. Many had been ferried to Panama to dig the canal. And I guess there's an interesting parallel with the experience of Ireland here. Ireland obviously has this long history of almost kind of 800 years of colonisation by England and then obviously Great Britain, and has throughout that time, particularly in the 18th and 19th and 20th centuries, exported its population And the economic hardships of Ireland, particularly in the 19th century, during the era of the famine and thereafter, see not just this flow of kind of Irish refugees almost from famine in coffin ships across the Atlantic, but also this flow of surplus labour into England, which is a key factor in England's Industrial Revolution. Not only were impoverished Irish labourers and their families crossing the Irish Sea to places like Liverpool and Bristol, and here where I am, Cardiff, in order to, in some cases, literally to eat. But wages were, on average, better in England, in Britain. And the role that Irish labour had in building railways and viaducts and the infrastructure of modern industrial Britain is huge and should never be kind of overlooked. Here, where I live in Cardiff, the eastern side of the city is built not exclusively by Irish labour, but with a massive, massive contribution from it, all the way down to the docks, which became part of the which became the largest coal port in the world in the mid 19th century. And so that's the sort of thing that surplus labour does. If it is employed, often with kind of exploitative relations and brutality and hardship, but the moving of surplus labour round empires transforms them. One of the paradoxes at the moment here in kind of increasingly xenophobic Europe is that with ageing populations and increasingly sort of xenophobic anti-migration policies, the countries that allow themselves, I say allow themselves as if it's some sort of nice thing they're doing, the countries that open their doors to migrant labour are the ones whose economies grow. And so there are countless examples where migrant labour is not only just desirable, but is actually essential. And the energy and the work and the skills that migrant labour, not just migrant labour, but British imperial citizens, because you have to remember that most of the people who came on the SS Windrush were British citizens. They were holders of British passports that these British citizens brought to the United Kingdom in the post-war era were one of the key reasons why there was the economic activity that there was, and the Britain's economic performance throughout the post-war era wasn't exactly stellar, certainly not by the time you get to the 1970s and 1980s, but that's an entirely different story. Eddie Chambers writes, though reflecting no end of deeply troubling pathologies around race, freely expressed at the time, the book The Panama Canal, written by Frederick J. Haskin and published in 1913, at just about the time when this monumental feat of engineering and construction was completed, is an invaluable reference to Caribbean workers' involvement in the enterprise. According to Haskin, the government paid the West Indian labourer 90 cents a day, furnished him with free lodgings in quarters, and sold him 3 square meals a day at 9 cents each, a total of 27 cents a day for board and lodging. On the balance of 63 cents, the West Indian Negro who saved was able to go back home and become a sort of Rockefeller amongst his compatriots. His possible savings, as a matter of fact, were about 2.5 times the total wages he received in his native country. Later on, in his references to workers from the Caribbean, Haskin claimed that those Negroes who were industrious, constant and thrifty saved all they could, worked a steady year or two, and then went back to Jamaica or Barbados to invest their money in a bit of land and become freeholders and consequently better citizens. That's a fascinating turn of phrase, to better citizens. The sort of property ownership kind of magically transforms you into some sort of morally superior sort of human being. It was then reported that the Negro labourers at first were obtained by recruiting agents at work in the various West Indian islands, principally Jamaica and Barbados. This recruiting service carried about 30,000 to the Isthmus, of whom 20,000 were from Barbados, but the Isthmus obviously being the canal, and 6,000 from Jamaica. Earlier in this particular chapter, Haskins has stated the West Indian Negro contributed about 60% of the brawn required to build the Panama Canal. There was one other significant reason why migrants from the British Caribbean wanted to enter whatever labour market there might have been in Britain. Frankly, there were precious few other destinations open to them. The USA had instigated draconian restrictions that limited Caribbean migration to a derisory annual figure. The door to North America was quickly shut by the McCarran-Walter Act in 1952, which limited the number of British West Indians who could settle in the USA from 65,000 a year to only 800. People turned instead to Britain and exercised their rights, as their passports indicated, as British subject, citizen of the United Kingdom of the Colonies. Another commentator put the figure of Caribbean immigrants allowed into the USA by the McCarran-Walter Act at a far lower figure, though this was likely to be on account of the act allowing for 100 persons per Caribbean territory per year. However, the sentiments of migrants expected citizenship were constant with the other such views expressed. Unaware of Britain's hostility towards immigrants, the first large group of West Indians who stepped on board the Empire Windrush in June 1948 thought they were coming home. Some had spent their war years in the RAF stationed in Britain, and all of them had been brought up to believe that England was the mother country. Prevented from going to the USA by the McCarran-Walter Act in 1952, The restricted immigration from the West Indies to 100 a year, most of the West Indians who followed the Pilgrim's boat expected to be welcomed in Britain and felt they had fulfilled their dreams. Which again, some of that might well be hyperbole, but the McCarran Act there sort of there's an important and powerful clue there that there was this huge push factor to escape the poverty of the West Indies, but not necessarily a pull factor to Great Britain exclusively. The first place, the place where it would be easier to get to, nearer, and certainly a place that was economically booming in a way that Great Britain wasn't after the Second World War, was of course America. But the American door, when the American door swung shut, with no small amount of kind of racism intended during the increasingly xenophobic and racialized climate of the early 1950s, Britain then becomes a much more attractive destination, or somewhere where, you know, you look at your prospects, think, America I can't get into, but I do have this British passport, and we've all been told these things about Great Britain. And there are multiple connections that people have with Britain, perhaps partly due to wartime service or other kind of transatlantic connections, and a sense that Britain is somewhere where will be welcome and treated well. And it is the shock of what actually happens there that changes and shapes this culture amongst Black Britons that throughout the subsequent decades. Eddie Chambers writes, "Incidentally, black dissatisfaction and unhappiness at what were regarded as dreadful conditions and treatment were not confined to the mid to late 20th century Britain. The great Jamaican-born Pan-African visionary and agitator for black rights, Marcus Garvey, was dismayed at the conditions he encountered and observed among the Jamaican labourers referenced by Winder. In his mid-1920s, Garvey travelled to Costa Rica. One of Garvey's biographers noted, the United Fruit Company was currently expanding its operations in Costa Rica, and Garvey's uncle secured a job for the Jamaican as timekeeper on the company's banana plantations. The plight of the Negro field workers, many of them his countrymen, only increased Garvey's determination to improve the lot of Negroes everywhere." There is a kind of, obviously, a de facto wage slavery where notionally free labour can be treated in a manner very similar to the way one would treat slaves, by simply keeping them hostage through the means of low wages. Garvey subsequently travelled to Bocas del Toro in Colón, Panama, where he observed with great indignation the inferior status of the Negro workers on the Panama Canal, which was nearing completion at the time. From Colón, Garvey moved to Ecuador, where he observed Negro labourers being exploited in the mines and tobacco fields. And then he went on to compare conditions in Nicaragua, Honduras, Colombia, and Venezuela. His widow, Mrs. Amy Jacques Garvey, recorded that, sickened with fever and sick at heart over appeals from his people for help on their behalf, he returned to Jamaica. Another Garvey, Mrs. Amy Ashwood Garvey, the first wife of Marcus Garvey and in her own right a Pan-Africanist, activist and feminist, had significant connections to Panama. Born in Jamaica, she was raised in Panama, where her father operated a print shop. Predictably, Garvey's reported horror at the plight of black workers on the construction of the Panama Canal contrasted with the benevolent tone and confident claim made at the time of Garvey's visit, when the construction of the canal was nearing completion, that black workers were treated well. Upon completion of the canal, it was claimed that the worker from the Caribbean, upon repatriation, would miss the life of on the isthmus. He worked harder, he was treated better, and he was paid higher wages than he will ever again be paid in his life. Okay, so that's our sort of beginning on this topic. I think I did do something on this a while back, but this is the first time we've taken a substantial bite out of it, and we'll be returning again in the next few weeks, I think, to look more closely at the question of the development of a post-war black identity in Britain. Thanks very much for listening to the Explaining History podcast. Do remember, we're on YouTube as well, so you can check out the shorts we put up there. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.